Hi, welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm Andrew Kadenak. Joining me is John Purcell, and I would like to say the man formerly known as that movie guy, now media superstar, Mark Fennell.
Oh, that's nice. I was expecting you to just say media slut, so this is much nicer. Media slut.
Yeah. Well, I think that URL's taken, but we don't want to talk about that.
I'm still in negotiations to see if I can buy it back.
So we're talking about Planet According to the Movies, which is a new book.
Yes, it is my new book. And I was just saying to you guys before they pressed the button on that it is definitely the strangest experience holding a physical copy of a book that you wrote exclusively between the hours of midnight and 3 a.m. And if the book smells like gin, it's because a lot of it was written under the influence of gin. In fact, I think the first book I wrote, that movie book, I did actually thank Bombay Sapphire and the many lime growers of Australia at the back end of it, because it was like, without you, this book would have made a lot more sense. I think this time around, I'm mostly thanking like Nescafe for the between the hours of midnight and 3 a.m.
Now, did you write this? Was there an iPad experience on this one?
Or no. There was.
We should explain that little in joke there.
Yeah, so on the first book, I actually did write, my laptop died halfway through, and I did end up writing it a lot on an iPad. And then I remember the notes coming back from the publisher. They're like, so is there a reason why it doesn't make any sense at all? I'm like, well, I mean, it could be the fact that I'm an idiot, or I'm going to blame the iPad. And they're like, oh, right, an iPad, that makes much more sense. And she talked exactly like that.
That's a generic publisher.
If Joe is listening to this, I'm so sorry, that's not at all what you sound like. there was no iPad. This is a solid Google Docs production from GoToWire. I should have thanked Google in the back end. You know, that is actually the last thing that I wrote, and I only finished writing the acknowledgements like 2 weeks ago. And I remember sitting on the balcony just going, it's over. It's finally done. Yeah. So it's a very, I'm having a very surreal experience at the moment. So if you think, wow, this guy's not making a great deal of sense, pin it on that.
And it's kind of long awaited, I want to say, because the first book, when was the first book?
Yeah, so the first book was the end of 2011. Yep. And shortly after that, I agreed to 3 different jobs at the same time. And then I think I'm kind of shit at it. You know, like I think some people, I have lots of friends that are writers and they live for that process of sitting down and just getting lost in the words. And actually what I find works best for me is I like talking to people and talking to things about, you know, what I just found, and then seeing how their face lights up when I say certain things and going, oh, that works. And then writing that down, that's the process that works best for me. So for me, it's a terrible thing to say when you're promoting a book, but I don't feel like I'm a natural born writer. I feel like it's an acquired skill, and I write in my voice. I write the way I talk and the way people hear me on the radio or on TV. So it took me a while, I guess, to find out what it is, the kind of book that I wanted to do next. And honestly, in between this, there was an idea about doing a cookbook that one day I am still determined to do. And I vividly remember having a meeting with HarperCollins and going, I just think cookbooks have peaked. I just don't think people buy them anymore. I'm like, are you for real? But don't worry, if you see a book from me that's a cookbook in another year or so, you'll know that it's been a long time coming.
Scoop.
There you go. Yeah. It's definitely a scoop.
I just have a question. Do you know actually how to cook?
No, I do. I cook a great deal. And it would be in line with something like this book, but through the prism of food. I'm not going to say any more on the off chance that it dies or somebody else does it better. And then I can sue them. It wouldn't necessarily involve me cooking. It would involve me setting a challenge to other people to cook. And I'm going to stop telling you that story.
It's good. Well, let's go back from the tangential. Mm. Let's focus on this. And tell us about the book, because it's exciting. We've just been talking next door about it a little bit. And it's weird, wacky, and it has a lot to do with your current job, which is, once again, you still have the coolest job in Australia.
So I think the specific job that relates to this is on SBS, I front all of the cult movies that they play across the week. And what we tend to do is we tend to find weird movies from around the world and, you know, break them down into different genres. So we'll do movie Slay Him, or the title for the slot is Movie Mayhem. We'll do a zombie season, we'll do a kung fu season. And it kind of reminded me, actually, of my early days of being a film critic, where it was all about finding amazing films from around the world. And I loved this idea of doing sort of like a Lonely Planet for movies. So if you were to travel from country to country and evaluate that country purely based on what movies say about it, what would you end up with? And invariably, you'd end up with a pretty skewed image of a country. And I found that fascinating. And I like writing in the cadence of like satirical Lonely Planet. I enjoy doing that. That's fun. as a frustrated travel writer, apparently. And so the book kind of works in a couple of different ways. So firstly, it is just a collection of books, of movies that I think are worth watching. Not necessarily because they're all great movies, because they're all movies that either have an amazing story behind them, or they are just like fascinatingly weird, or they're legitimately good. So there's that. So every movie in there is something I think is worth watching, just with varying levels of joy that you will get out of the other end. So there's a couple of different kinds of chapters you find in the book. So each chapter is broken down to a different country and a different running theme that I've noticed through movies either made in that country or about that country. And so so you'll get chapters where, you know, the Japan chapter is all about, there's a fascinating genre that is unique to Japan of sport films where a human faces off against a giant stuffed animal. And my favourite one, and I think it's your favourite one too,
yeah,
is Calamari Wrestler.
Oh.
I also like Executive Koala. Executive Koala is a very serious... And this is the thing, they're all directed by the same guy, and his name escapes me, but it's a very serious crime drama. He's a salaryman. No one really acknowledges the fact that he's a koala. He's being he's suspected of committing a crime.
Can we go back to the koala part just for a second? Is he a koala, though? Or is he just a guy who's got, like, great, fluffy grey hair?
Never really explained. I mean, they just kind of leave it there. But the thing is, it's very, very serious, except for the music video that happens about halfway through it. So, those sorts of things. Like, film genres that are unique to a country, I find incredibly fascinating. And some of them are, like, out-and-out weird like that. The other great one I love is the Indonesia chapter, which is Indonesia have this amazing history of just remaking films from other parts of the world. And Lady Terminator... You can actually, if you're listening to this now, go to YouTube, look it up, just watch the trailer, and you will just, your mind, something in your brain will break. Because it's sort of like, it's like they've taken a bit of the plot of Terminator, quite a great deal of the plot of Terminator, also a touch of Alien, and then, you know, they've added in a whole extra layer of Indonesian folklore on top of it. And she's this underwater sea goddess who kills people with her vagina. It's all very... It's all very specific. But the thing of it is that what actually happened is that under the Suharto regime, they wanted to make more local production. And so you had you had all this money flowing from the government and from independent investors that were encouraged by the government to make more Indonesian films. And what was really popular were these sort of like video nasties, these horror films that were coming through, and they wanted to make their own. And you can actually see them, and it's this beautiful thing that you see time and time again over history, which is people imitate before they create. And the result is this wonderfully fascinating like culture clash of, you know, so many of the tropes that we're familiar with in Western horror mix with the uniqueness of Indonesian culture. And see, that's what I think is fascinating.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And then you get other ones which are just like... According to the complete history of film, Iceland does not exist as a country. Any film that's ever been made in Iceland has been made about another country. They've just happened to use Iceland. It's been the Garden of Eden in Noah. It's been outer space in Star Trek Into Darkness. It's been some evil parallel universe populated by demonic elves in Thor the Dark World. Like, it's never been... I think there is obviously a local Icelandic film industry, but really, most of the films made in Iceland... pretend like Iceland is not a place. Like even at the beginning of Batman Begins, the bit where he goes to go train with Liam Neeson.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be Tibet. They did all the insurance on it, and they went, we are not sending Christian Bale to Tibet next to the ever cuddly People's Republic of China in a disputed territory. Let's not shoot there.
Yeah.
And so they ended up in Iceland. And so I also love those stuff, the behind the scenes stories about how films ended up shooting in different places. One of the other ones I really enjoy is Vancouverland. Vancouver is an amazing city that does not exist as far as I'm concerned. Vancouver has pretended to be every city in the world.
It's Juno, right?
Juno is in there, yep, yeah, yep. Yeah. And but there's like there's all this great stuff from the location guy who worked on Juno who's somehow written articles about picking the locations of Juno. I don't know what possessed him to do that, but it was very helpful for me. But yeah, so I've that's the sort of stuff I find interesting. So it's a little bit of ephemera, it's a little bit of trivia, but it's also sort of about evaluating culture through film and film through culture.
Well, and it's the old thing, isn't it? If you loved Apocalypse Now, your favourite film will be Hearts of Darkness.
Yes.
Like, yeah, there is always that story behind it.
Well, yeah, and actually on that, there's I'm just going to turn off my phone because I realise it's horrible that it's going off.
It's a podcast, you know, it's all free.
The Vietnam chapter is about the Vietnam War because in popular culture, even though Vietnam is obviously its own country and has its own history that, you know, exists quite separate from the war, in terms of its footprint on cinema culture, the war is still the largest thing that hangs over it in terms of what the sheer breadth of films that have been made about Vietnam. Now, there's tons of really great independent filmmakers in Vietnam that make some beautiful films, but in terms of the shadow that looms over it in popular culture, if you just to, you know, go through all of the different films, the war reigns over it all. And what's interesting, though, is most of the films made about Vietnam are obviously from an American point of view, so as far as America's concerned, Vietnam is about them. And I think I joke at the beginning of the film where, you know, I joke at the beginning of the book, you know, isn't this book just potentially just a little bit racist? I'm like, no, it's very racist. Because when you start to look at broad strokes in popular culture, people do start drawing in sort of shorthand, and inevitably you tend to lean on stereotypes. And exploring when stereotypes get used and exploring how they get used and how they develop is also interesting. So it's also kind of a film a little bit about racism. So it's a little bit of a film about racism.
Yeah.
I was wondering about the Australian context, because we do that to ourselves in a way. So there's so many movies which really play up this particular kind of Australian, and we sort of get represented overseas over and over again. We've got the...
The World's Beach.
Yeah, you know, The Crocodile, then Dundee, to even... Brains has gone...
But all those Ausploitation films as well, leading into it.
Yeah. I mean, Days of Patrick and Razorback and all those... And all those amazing films that, if you've never seen before, there's an amazing movie. I've forgotten the name. It's directed by Mark Hartley, and I've completely forgotten the name.
I've got your book.
Oh, Not Quite Hollywood. Not Quite Hollywood is the one I'm thinking of. Yeah. It's an amazing film about this hidden history. In fact, it's very, very similar to the Indonesia stuff I was talking about before. Yeah. There was a period in the 1970s where there was a lot of money flowing into Australian film. There was quite a big company called Pentagon. Hexagon rather, who were funding, who I think is a Village Roadshow, or there's a relationship now in the history through Village Roadshow where they just funneled lots and lots of money into making action films, horror films, car chase films, sexploitation films, and you know, in amongst a lot of the trash, and there was tons of trash, there were some great films that were made in that period, you know,
and low budget,
yeah,
which reaps, you know, the margin with box office and everything.
Low budget, but 100% audience focus.
Yeah,
you know, there was a mentality then that, you know, you really had to reach an audience. And a couple of weeks ago, I interviewed on my TV show The Feed the Graham Burke, who started Village Roadshow, and he's the guy that originally funded Mad Max, and he tells this great story about how Byron Kennedy and George Miller walk in, and they pitch him this film, and he's just like, mate, it's taking you 15 minutes to sell me this, and I've got to sell this in a 30-second ad, and you can't sell it to me in a quarter of an hour. No. And so they'd come in with some waffle, and they came back 2 weeks later, and they slapped down Mad Max, and they had one page just like, it's just a chase, and this happens, and this happens, and then they die. And he's like, yep, that'll work. And he's, you know, he's still working with those guys today. He's, you know, he's his relationship continues with them today, and they made Fury Road together, and they're all happy and reaping in the glory that's come from that. So, yeah, there is there is that amazing period in Australian film that, again, I just don't think it gets covered very much.
Yeah. So let's step back for a second and let's talk about. Increasingly in the internet age, with piracy and things like that, there is more access to weird stuff. Now, not necessarily a DVD store, but there's it probably took a step back maybe 5 years ago, and now that weird stuff is back on, people know how to put it on the webs, on things like that. How difficult is it to find weird stuff that nobody's heard of?
It's a very valid point, because it can be quite hard, because what...
The Room. I mean, I've seen The Room now.
But The Room is like very special though, because The Room became memeable, right?
Yeah.
I think when you lose the video store, what we lost was whimsy to a degree, where like stumble across. So the beauty, like much like a library or a bookstore, physical environments where you walk into a place, you look around, something leaps out at you that you haven't seen before, something leaps out at you that surprises you, you have a potential to lose that experience. I do believe that it's been replaced by something that is not bad, like the environment of streamable and YouTube and torrents has also given us a different kind of stumble across and a different kind of whimsy. But I personally do miss the experience of walking into a room and seeing, oh my God, why is there, you know, like an amazing poster, an amazing cover that just, and like titles that were ridiculous and said exactly what they were, like Lady yeah. Terminator or something like that.
Clash of the Titans. Titans yes. will clash.
Yes, exactly. Right. Perfect. Like ones that, and it was just a different way of encountering a film.
Hmm.
That said, you know, there's nothing in this book that you can't find either on, you know, one of the movie streaming services or on YouTube or online. Even the film executive produced by Kim Jong-il in the North Korean chapter, Pulgasari, which is basically his rip-off of Godzilla, where Godzilla is a giant dragon made out of rice and represents the evils of capitalism. Even that you can find in its entirety on YouTube. Wow. So, like, there's nothing in here that you can't get access to. Because that's, like, it's also, if you're going to write a book filled with film recommendations, it's kind of a dick move to have something that you can't watch. The movie that's also in the Japanese chapter that's got a plush cat that becomes a master ramen chef, competitive ramen chef, who competes with humans who own normal actual pets that are cats. So this is a film that has a plush cat facing off against humans that have pet cats that are real. There's no internal logic to this film whatsoever. That you can find in its entirety either on YouTube or I doubt you'll find it on Netflix, but you can definitely watch it on YouTube.
Oh, I'm going to check out Calamari Wrestler as soon as
I was wondering, with your role in doing all the different films for SBS, you're bringing a different, completely different feel to SBS. I get the opinion, feel that when I used to watch SBS movies, it was always late night, it was always foreign, it was always sex involved, but you're bringing a whole range of other...
We're problems. Still interested in foreign and sex, but
I was going to say, my mum,
we're down with foreign and sex.
My mum tells me she's worried how many times on a Saturday morning she will turn the TV on. She's left out watching the footy, and she goes, SBS News is on.
That can mean only one thing. When I was first hired by SBS, I was very young, I was 19 years old, and I did joke at the time, you know, journalists would ask me, so what's your experience of SBS? I'm like, well, everything I know about sex I learned from SBS. They're like, wow, you've had some fucked up pages. I think there is, because of the two channel split, so SBS 1 is still very much concerned with like prestige sorts of films, Amelie, basically things that fit into the Amelie box of, you know, French and Gerard Depardieu will probably pop up and you can put the Khan logo on the promo. Like, I think they're still very concerned with that, and that's fine. A lot of those films are brilliant and I adore them. What I do is more fun. Like the movie Mayhem slots, the Indie Mondays, and they just get an amazing selection of movies. And you know, we do mix in some well-known retro stuff. So there's a lot of 80s action, a lot of 80s horror that's very popular, that does really well. But in the mix there, you've also got like really fascinating films from around the world. In fact, like one of my favourite chapters in this book that was ripped off from a season we did on SBS is all about zombies around the world. Like which culture is best equipped to fight off zombies. And though we've got a Cuban zombie movie, an English zombie movie, and just like going through the different cultures and seeing how different cultures attack the idea is great. It's really fun. And that was just like an enormously fun movie season and an enormously fun movie season to shoot because the intros we do to those movies have sort of been getting progressively more ridiculous over time. It started off with just me sitting in a set, you know, on a chair like this, you know, going, you should watch this film. It's good. It starts now. The last time we did it, I was being attacked, like we shot the Halloween movie season and they had one of the interns, one of the production coordinators dress up like a full-size Chucky doll and attack me in the background while I was doing it. Like, is this what we're doing today? And they don't tell me, right? They don't tell me until like a day before. And so I'm getting there going, right, well, this is weird. I mean, it's good Instagram fodder, but it's weird.
A full-size Chucky doll.
Oh, he's so creepy. I'll send you a picture later.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's insane. So
he gets to keep that, right?
I assume so. I mean, I'm actually weird. It would be weird if he ever took it off. Yeah, I mean, exactly, yeah. If you get that opportunity, you're like, I'm going to follow through on that for the rest of my life.
So with your knowledge, I'm going to test your knowledge and also we talk about
oh,
this.
God, okay.
I'm going to throw a genre movie at you.
Yeah, yeah.
And you tell me what country you think does it best.
Oh, this is a great game.
Okay.
Let's do it. I'm in.
Ready?
Okay. Yep.
Zombies.
Cuba. There's a film called Wine of the Dead, which is fantastic. And the beautiful thing about the film is that Cubans are so laissez-faire and so resourceful in this particular film because they've had to deal with the sort of like the economic sanctions and whatnot, that in the film they've done a really great job of capturing the fact that they're just super resourceful at just getting shit done, even though infrastructure doesn't work. And because of that, they are very, very well suited to fighting off zombies. In that chapter, you find the country that copes with it the least is France. There's a French soccer film where it's like, sort of like, it's a weird movie which is, has two directors and you can really tell, which is they want to make the point that like soccer hooligans are kind of like zombies. That's the point they want to make. And then it becomes like a class war. They are clearly the least equipped, according to film. This is the thing I have to keep saying so it doesn't just sound like he's making broad generalizations about the entire French people. According to film, the French are useless at zombies.
Is a man he dead? Why not let him walk the streets? What is the problem?
Exactly.
Let him eat the bread.
In my mind, I've got Shaun the Dead and they're throwing the LPs at the end.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when it came to picking, an English film, I really ummed and ahed because like everyone has seen Shaun of the Dead. Like Shaun of the Dead is so well known and loved that I went looking for another one, and one I ended up with was Cockneys versus Zombies, which is a less well known film but far stupider. Just because it's about
much
a bunch
more
of,
rhyming
yeah,
stuff.
It's a bunch of Cockney thieves and a bunch of Cockney old people from a nursing home that team up together to fight off zombies.
Oh, that's the best.
There you go.
Is that? Well,
that's Cockneys versus Zombies.
Okay. Car chase films.
Car chase films. It is hard to beat Americans for car chase films. But by simple virtue of the fact that we have George Miller, I'm going to say Us.
Excellent.
And I'm going to say Us by way purely based on the Mad Max franchise. Even though Fury Road was shot in Namibia, they were going to shoot it in here, but it turns out we weren't having a drought anymore.
That's right.
I'm just in the interest of patriotism, I'm going to say we do them really well.
Nice. Okay. Easy vampires. I mean, not easy for you, but easy for me to think about.
Yeah, vampires. Well, Germans. It would be like, you know, yeah. Herzog and,
yep.
And, you know, I think Germans have definitely got the strongest track record with making really, really creepy vampire movies. And you go back to things, you go back to Nosferatu, which was if you go back and look at Nosferatu, which is one of the earliest depictions of vampires on film. You look at it and go, and the story behind Nosferatu was it was basically a rip-off of Bram Stoker's Dracula, but they changed all the names for copyright reasons. So this is an issue back then in the 1920s. And even then, the Bram Stoker's wife tried to have a ban because we're too close. Anyway, if you go back and look at that film, the visual language of what we now know as modern horror, so sort of, you know, visual tension in a frame where so something's in the background and or there's an empty space in the frame, you think something's going to pop out at you, or just the look of him with the long nails and stuff like that. So much of what we now regard as being like archetypal vampire imagery was refined in that film. Like obviously vampires as a concept, it existed in literature long before that, but so much of what we think is of the visual shorthand of that was crystallized in that film. That is the benchmark from which all other, you know, zombie fiction spins out from in terms of film culture. So definitely Germans.
I get the feeling if there's a further decline in civilization, that film will be rolled out as evidence of vampires.
Yeah, exactly.
The footage from years ago.
Yeah. Exactly. Right.
Monster movies.
Oh, okay. Reduce it down. Which
amphibious?
Like,
are we talking like? What do you mean?
Amphibious? Like, break down which kinds of monsters.
Okay, gigantic monsters. No. Monsters as big. I'll give you 10 stories or above.
Okay, well, I mean, clearly that's Japan.
Yeah.
I mean, like, they have a huge problem with giant monsters just walking out and stomping over entire postcodes. Just like, and you know my favourite thing about, like, and obviously we're talking about Godzilla there, but Godzilla and the whole genre of, like, guys in giant rubber outfits stomping over Osaka. That whole thing is endlessly fascinating to me because, like, what in the height of those movies, mayors of different Japanese cities would campaign in the same way that we campaign for, like, who's going to get the Olympics. They would campaign to have their city stomped out by Godzilla or Mothra or, you know, and stuff like that. And it was a big deal for a while. Like, we're talking about 70s, 80s. It's not so much a big deal now. But, you know, it's interesting if you go back to the very first Godzilla movie. So it was 1954's. And there's a Japanese version and then there's a re-edited Japanese version where they've inserted an American guy so they could sell it to the American market. It's weird. But you go back to the original version and we think about Godzilla as being, like, sort of hilarious. It's, like, it's kind of funny. It's a guy in a rubber suit. But the first movie they made is very dark. It's really dark and really somber and really heavy. And what you realize watching it is that this is a externalization of the fear of nuclear power by the only nation that had seen it at its worst. Mm. And, you know, that sense of terror, that sense of like dense sadness sits over that film in a way that we don't necessarily associate with that genre anymore, because it obviously it permutated and became something else since then. But it's really interesting to go back and watch the first attempts, or the beginnings of genres, like in the same way that Nosferatu was kind of interesting, because it was about going back to the start of a genre, seeing how it looked at the beginning, realizing how much we're still reliant on the imagery born out of one particular film, is still something I find really fun about film. It's why writing books like this is fun, because when you're a film critic who reviews things that come out week after week, you kind of get into a thing where you're like, okay, well, here's the Marvel movie of the week, because it feels like there's 50 fucking Marvel films that come out a year. Yep. And I like them, they're fun. But it's really fun to go back and see where the thread starts.
Yeah.
You know, I love that. That's what I really enjoy. I love seeing how we've changed things over time and how we haven't changed things over time and how they, you know, where those ideas began. And so that's the stuff that I, like, actually writing about film history, and realistically what the book actually is a book about film history. Mm. I've taken a film history, I've taken, like, the first 2 years of film school and I've put it, surrounded it in jokes and listicles. And that's what the book is. It's film, it's cultural theory masquerading as listicles.
Well, that's it. You've got your pitch. You've been waiting
it's,
for
it's
it.
A, yeah, it's only taken me, what, 40 minutes?
Well, that's fantastic. I can't recommend it enough. This is... If everyone's experience with this book is like this conversation, winning every time. Marky, thank you so much for coming in and chatting to us.
The pleasure is entirely mine, and I'm sorry about my high-pitched nasal voice. You don't get that reading the book. You don't get the pitch, you just get the words.
And remember at home, you can get Planet According to the Movies from booktopia.com.au right now.
Do it!
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.